Thank you for spending part of your evening with us, and I'll be brief. First, I want to acknowledge the National President of the Society, Gene Meyer, who's here somewhere. Gene, could you came up for this event? And also the chapter director, Lisa Ezel, who's also come up for the event. She guides New York and all the other chapters. Two quick programming notes. Society's National Lawyers Convention takes place in November 11 to 13 in Washington. Registration is open. It will fill up fast. You can find out about it on the website and register there. Next, the New York Young Lawyers chapter will host a Supreme Court update in this club on Tuesday, October 12th. Again, registration details are on the website. You will note all that this event is being video recorded. All right, now to our panelists. Many great things could be said about each one of them, so I'll just stick with the most relevant highlights. Judge Mukasey, you know, all of our panelists are great Americans, but the judge is also a great New Yorker. Born in New York, educated on the Upper East Side, Columbia University. He left for a little while to go to law school, but you know, New Haven is kind of like a distant borough anyway. So, back in New York, he practiced law for 20 years, and then was one of the most distinguished judges on the Southern District of New York for 20 years. Many crucial terrorism cases. He stepped down in 2006. But was soon called back to public service as the U.S. Attorney General from 2007 to 2009. Jim Haynes was a ROTC candidate who went on to law school, commissioned as an Army officer on active duty from 84 to 88. He advised and represented the Army. He then spent a brief time in private practice and was tapped to become general counsel to the Department of the Army from 90 to 93. You'll recall that was Desert Storm and Desert Shield. In the rest of the 90s, he had various positions in the private sector. And then for almost the entirety of the George W. Bush administration, he was the general counsel to the Department of Defense, always in the room. when things were happening. Mary Beth Buchanan became an assistant U.S. attorney in the Western District of Pennsylvania shortly after law school, stayed, started in the civil division, went to the criminal division. While still in her 30s, she was nominated to be the U.S. attorney for the Western District of Pennsylvania. She was nominated on September 5th, 2001. She was confirmed on September 14th, 2001. The Western District, you may remember, includes Shanksville. She's also the president of the Federalist Society's New York chapter. One final thing. We need to recognize some of the people who aren't here tonight. Donald Rumsfeld, and longtime CIA lawyer John Russo passed away this year. Each dedicated his life to the country to the best of his ability and judgment. And we also need to recognize the 13 Marines and soldiers and Navy corpsmen who died 2 weeks ago, who in some ways were the most recent victims of 9/11. So we'll take a moment of silence. And then we'll begin. Thank you. Mary Beth, your show.
Thank you very much, Vince. And Vince, thank you for organizing this program tonight, for creating the program, for getting us such incredible panelists. If it were not for Jim, this would not have come together. And it is the first in-person event that we have held since our February program with Nikki Haley. So we are really happy to be back, and we are so happy that you are here with us tonight. As we approach the 20th anniversary of September 11, 2001, I would like to take us back to that day, which changed the United States, really, and the world forever. And we would like to talk tonight about where we were, what we were doing, both on that morning and in the aftermath that followed. As I'm leading this conversation, I'll kick off with what I was doing, and then I'll turn to the panelists. So as Vince said, I was an assistant U.S. attorney in the Western District of Pennsylvania in 2001. In August of 2001, I was approached by the Justice Department after, of course, a lengthy search to tell me that the president had made a choice and he would be nominating me to serve in the role of United States Attorney, and that I had the option of going in an acting capacity, or I could wait and, you know, wait for the nomination. So there are pros and cons. The pro of taking the acting appointment is that I could get started right away and, you know, put my stamp on the district and get to work, you know, in the office and throughout the Western District. But the bad thing was that if you took the temporary appointment, you might get put to the back of the line and not get, you know, not actually get confirmed. And finally, my reason for not taking it was that I had a vacation planned, almost 2 weeks in Spain, and I knew that once I hit the ground running, I would not be getting a vacation for quite a while. So I decided to pass on the acting role, go on the vacation, and you know, see what happened. So a few days into the vacation, on September 5th, I got the call that the president had nominated me. So obviously I was overjoyed, I was so excited. You know, the vacation was wonderful, but I was also looking forward for the first time in my life to returning from a vacation and getting back to work. So on September 11th, the vacation ended and we boarded a flight from Madrid to Philadelphia. That flight was Flight 11. It was a 767 and it was a US Airways flight. So I was sitting in first class, and I'm normally chatty anyway, but I was particularly chatty that day because I was telling all of the flight attendants that, you know, I was the first woman ever appointed in any district in Pennsylvania, and that I was so excited to get back and, you know, get to work. So the flight takes off a couple of hours in. One of the flight attendants came back, and she walked right up to me, and she said, "You wouldn't believe, but a plane hit the World Trade Center." And I said, I couldn't think of anything to say. I said, "Why, that's crazy, right?" So then she came back again and told me about the second plane. And I don't know what it was, why she wanted to talk to me. I think she wanted to talk to someone. And because I had told her that I, you know, would be in an official role, I think she wanted, you know, wanted to share the information. So then she came back a third time and she told me about the plane that hit the Pentagon. And each time she would share a little more information. So she pointed to the aircraft instruction and said, "It's a 767, that's what we're on." And then she said, "The first plane, it was number 11. And then she said, "It's hijackers." And she's telling me these things and I'm just sitting here like taking in all this information, not able, you know, obviously to do anything. And then she came back a fourth time, almost in tears, to tell me that she was sorry to tell me that a plane had crashed in Pittsburgh. And so obviously we didn't know anything, or you knew something at this point. But shortly then the pilot got on the PA system and said words that I will never forget. "As a result of multiple terrorist acts in the US today, all US airspace is closed. We will be turning around and landing in Madrid in 2.5 hours. So we were like midway, I guess. And then it was just silence. It was silence, maybe some sobbing. And then when we landed in Madrid, the airport was pretty deserted and we were met by people from the State Department who told us that almost 30,000 people were dead. And it was just such a frustrating experience to feel like I was supposed to be in this district and I'm not in the district, and this you know, catastrophe has happened today. So at this point, I'm going to turn to the other panelists. It took me 5 more days to get back into the United States. And that was another hectic ordeal, just trying to get back and then hitting the ground running. But I can come back to some of the other things that we did at the crash site and that we did to gather information. But Jim, you were on the job on 9/11. Tell us what you were doing. Tell us what it was like in the Pentagon that day.
Sure. Well, first off, thank you all for inviting me. I was talking to the judge earlier and haven't really done very much of this retrospective. And here we are 20 years later. And even now trying to absorb the enormity of what this country, what the world experienced, is still hard to grasp. But thank you. I want to thank the Federalist Society. Gene, good to see you. Thank you for being here. Liz, thank you. Judge Prescott, nice to see you. So 20 years ago, everybody often talks about how beautiful the day was on the East Coast. I didn't really see the early part of the day. Donald Rumsfeld had been confirmed early in 2001, and even though he was the oldest Secretary of Defense ever to serve, he had been the youngest Secretary of Defense ever to serve. So he was in round two, and he had a mission. And those of us who worked for Donald Rumsfeld had to be there early, and we had to be there ready to work. So I was there before the crack of dawn on 9/11, and the front page of the Washington Post was talking about, among other things, the speech that the secretary had given the day before, and the subtitle was "The War on Bureaucracy." Guess who was target number one? Lawyers. One of Rumsfeld's rules is that lawyers are like beavers. They just build dams and get in the way. So anyway, lovable client. You gotta love them. The day started as usual early. It was at a staff meeting. The secretary was not at the early morning staff meeting because he was meeting with some members of Congress over breakfast in his private dining room. I walked out of the senior staff meeting and through the secretary's front office, and there on the TV was a photograph of the first tower. Walked down about 50 yards down the river entrance of the Pentagon, and I should describe the Pentagon. It's ironically, the Pentagon, the country broke ground to build the Pentagon on September 11th, 1941. The notion was to build a veterans hospital. It's an enormous building. Currently houses over 25,000 employees. It's 5 sides, it's 5 above ground floors, it's got 5 concentric pentagons in it. And on the river entrance is where the secretary's office, the deputy secretary's office, and some of the senior staff on the third floor. And the second floor is the chairman of the Joint Chiefs and the vice chairman. And underneath that is the NMCC, the National Military Command Center, which is where you've seen on the movies like War Games and things like that, where all the big screens are about what's happening in the world. So I left the secretary's front office, walked down to my office, called a couple of people, actually was on the phone with my good friend David Addington, who was general counsel for the vice president. And that's when the second tower was struck, and we both agreed it was time to get to work. I went down to what's called the Executive Support Center, right outside the secretary's office, to join a crisis action team, which we had recently reestablished. You know, the secretary's mission from President Bush was to transformed the Department of Defense from the Cold War operations to the modern era. And one of the things that we had done early was to set up a way to manage crises that had sort of fallen into desuetude in the last 8 years. While there were a few of us in that crisis action team, Secretary was still with the members of Congress. Something happened, and Steve Cambone, who was the Secretary's special assistant at the time, commented, "Wow, that was a loud HVAC change, heating, ventilating, air conditioner change." Enormous building, and it shook even then. And then it was like, if you remember the movie The Wizard of Oz, where it went from black and white to color, at that point it went from slow motion to fast forward speed. And the day was like that. As I think about it, and I've thought about it the last few days to try to think about how to capture what it was like to be a lawyer during that time, it's still hard to do. But I think there were, over the course of the day, and I didn't leave till after midnight that night, there were a few things that sort of categories of things that I had to deal with as a lawyer. And I was with the Secretary the whole time. He finally came back. It was continuity of operations. There's a program called COOP, COG, COOP, continuity of operations, COG, continuity of government. It's important for our country, probably any institution, to have for emergency situations. So there were things associated with that. There were things associated with record keeping of very important decisions. There was the function of the department to defend the country, so there were legal decisions associated with that. And then there was trying to think ahead. As Secretary Rumsfeld said to me many a day, he said, "Your job, Jim, among other things, is to look around corners for me." So to anticipate things that are coming around the corner. So back to that day, I was in this executive support center right across from the Secretary's office, three floors above the NMCC, the National Military Command Center. The Secretary was nowhere in sight, right? He was having breakfast with members of Congress. Now, going back to COOP and COG, we had protocols. One of those protocols was when something bad happens, and these protocols often, in many cases, go back decades, including the possibility of a thermonuclear war. The plans say that a team comes and gets the Secretary, and another team comes and gets the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs. There's a helicopter that comes in, and the Secretary is supposed to have a key team, supposed to have a communications guy, or man, woman, basically a way to keep in touch with the chain of command. The senior military assistant, in this case, there was a three-star named Admiral Ed Giambastiani, who later became Vice Chairman of the Joint Chiefs. A press person, a legislative affairs person, security detail, and the general counsel. Well, this was one of those situations. Did they come to get the lawyer? No. They didn't come to get the lawyer. They did come to get the Secretary. And he, as you may have read, said, "Screw that." I'm sure he said something worse than that. "I'm going to the crash site." So he went around two bevels of the building to start pulling people out of the building. There's some photographs of him associated with that. Now, he was later criticized, I think justifiably, for being out of touch, because we were, after the first plane, maybe it was an accident. Second plane, it was a terrorist event. Third plane, we're at war. But he was off pulling people out of the rubble and out of the chain of command. You'll remember the president was also hard to reach. He had been down in Florida at a school and was at that point airborne on his way to Barksdale Air Force Base. The Vice President was at the White House. Secretary was we knew where he was, but he was not connected with the President at that time, certainly not with me. But eventually, you know, that happens, right? I mean, you don't schedule a war. You certainly don't schedule a terrorist attack. That was it for a little while. Secretary did come back, of course, and I wish I had a diagram for you, but I was up on the third floor, right near the Secretary's office. We were in a vault with you've seen the big bank vaults that have the sort of the big wheels, and they're that thick, and we were connected with all these, they call them CVTCs, Secure Video Teleconference, SVTC, with the White House Situation Room, the Justice Department, the CIA, the State Department. Colin Powell, of course, was in South America at the time. I was a pretty senior guy, but I was still not in the chain of command. You know, it took a while for people to come together. I remember when the Secretary came back in, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff was also out of the Pentagon. The then current chairman had been in Europe. So Dick Myers, who was the chairman of the Joint Chiefs designate, who was going to take over on October 1st, I swore him in on October 1st, was the acting chairman. And for those first couple of hours, we would convene as a group in this vault on the third floor, and Dick Myers, would go up and down these stairs, three flights up and down to the NMCC, the National Military Command Center, where all of the communications from all of the military forces around the world were coming in. And at some point, the Secretary said, "I've had enough of this." So we all went down stairs, three flights of stairs into the NMCC, and wouldn't you know it, we could not get the secure video teleconference communications to work. We're down in the National Military Command Center of this most formidable military the world has ever seen. And because of the peace dividend of the previous 8 years, Soviet Union had collapsed. We were at the end of history and democracy was going to reign forever. We hadn't invested in communications gear. So we had difficulty connecting. Remember, the Secretary actually went over into a corner of this great great big cavernous command center and was on what they call the red switch, which is a secure telephone that he was speaking with the Vice President, and I think the President as well, who was airborne, who was also having trouble. The President was having trouble connecting from Air Force One. While Flight 93 was still airborne. We later found that out. And then, not being able to get communications, we started smelling smoke in the NMCC. And we didn't know what was going on.
You didn't know that the plane had hit the Pentagon?
Well, we knew the plane had hit the Pentagon. The Secretary was back. As soon as the plane hit, I was in this room, and there were all these video screens up, mostly not secure, but television stations. And those of you who lived that day may remember in those first hours in Washington, there were reports of a car bomb at the State Department, a bomb at the Capitol building, and of course, something at the Pentagon. And in retrospect, what that was the television cameras were where they were, and they were looking from distant vantage points and saw smoke billowing, and the background might have been different from different places. So I told you some of the things I focused on at the time were COOP and COG, continuity of operations, continuity of government. It was clear the secretary was not going to go to a remote location. He was in the chain of command. He was clearly not going to give up the steering wheel of the Pentagon in these circumstances. So I went to my deputy, Dan Del Orto, who was my alter ego, and I went to Paul Wolfowitz, who was the Deputy Secretary of Defense, and said, you guys have got to get out of here. You have to be the survivors, which they, you know, didn't want to go, but admirably did. And that's a whole nother story. It's somewhat amusing because, you know, this is sort of inside baseball about how the Office of the Secretary of Defense sometimes is the last one to get resources. And I remember Paul telling me later that he had gotten on a Huey aircraft, which is an old world Vietnam era helicopter, and seeing Tom White, who was Secretary of the Army, zooming by him to the remote location up in Pennsylvania under a mountain in a Black Hawk helicopter, which was far more modern. In any case, they went off, and Paul and I were talking and saying, you know, we can't get communications here. We really need, consistent with the concept of civilian control of the military, we really need a PAS, a presidential appointee, Senate confirmed, in contact. He said, you, Jim, go back upstairs to the vault there in the Executive Support Center, which I said, that makes sense. So I went back up there, got up there, was reconnected, and of course, okay, I'm connected, but the secretary's not. he's still down there. So it's, you know, it's fog of war kind of thing. Some things in retrospect are amusing, but I remember going back outside, and the halls of the Pentagon were like pea soup black smoke. And right outside the NMCC, there were these armed, they looked like ninja warriors. They, you know, gas masks, black clad, machine guns, back up. But everybody ended up back up there, including Dick Myers, and that's where we spent the rest of the day administering the Department of Defense. And during the course of that, some of the decisions that the Secretary had to make, you know, once the President, you know, he got to Barksdale Air Force Base, gave an address. You all have seen, if you don't remember it, maybe in recent days, you've seen some of the accounts. He then went, against his best wishes, to Offutt Air Force Base in Nebraska, which is a few hours away, before he finally came back to the White House late that night. But during that time, we had some pretty sporty occasions. There was a flight from Korea, Korean Airlines flight, I think 83 or 85, I can't remember which, was flying to Anchorage, Alaska. And at that time, inexplicable fashion, was squawking hijack, which is on the transponder, it's 7,500. And what had happened, we found out later, was that the pilot of that flight on that day was notified, like everybody else in the world probably who was flying an airplane, that there had been terrorist attacks. And there was a message that was sent to the pilots in code in case they had been hijacked. And the pilot, who was a Korean-speaking pilot on a Korean Airlines flight, sent a message back with the initials HJK at the end, which the recipient tried to interpret and wondered if that was hijacked. So they sent back a note saying, is this a hijack? If so, turn your transponder to 7,500. The pilot turned it to 7,500, thinking that's what he was instructed to do. So we scrambled aircraft, And for a couple hours, thought about what to do. One of my discussions with the secretary during that period of time was, what are the standing rules of engagement for NORAD, the North American Air Defense Agency, which is a joint U.S.-Canadian military command. And there are standing rules that allow the pilots to use self-defense in the event of a conflict in the air. But we had to consider what instructions to give them about other potential flights. But in this case, the Korean Airlines flight, there was a real question. And my sort of back of the envelope legal analysis is, say, you've got a duty and obligation and certainly authority to, as Secretary of Defense, to defend the country. There may be American citizens aboard, and there's a Fourth Amendment and a Fifth Amendment issue here of, is there an unreasonable seizure, and is there a deprivation of life without due process? My thought was, if you need to do that, you better get some cover from the boss. And he spoke with the president. So there was that incident. And then Mary Beth and I learned, or I learned from Mary Beth, I didn't realize that Mary Beth was on this US Air flight. The same day, we had reports that I'm not sure it was yours, but a US Air flight from Madrid, I don't know how many of them are that day.
Numbered flight 11.
Don't remember the number. I had notes from the time, but I didn't see anything recently about that. But we had reports that might have been hijacked. And so we were prepared to do, with authority to do what might have needed to be
done. Jim, if I haven't told you this before, thank you so much for making the right
call.
Well,
one thing a good lawyer does is he or she remembers there's a lawyer and there's a client. But those are some of the things that we did that day. There were many things. I said I left after midnight that day. The secretary was there until the president returned from his flights from Florida to Louisiana to Nebraska and then back again. So the secretary went late afternoon, early evening to the White House, but I stayed on. And we had, I'd mentioned record keeping. One of the things that was important to do, because there was so much confusion, uncertainty. I mean, first reports are almost always wrong. One of the things that I felt important was that we record on a real-time basis the directions that the secretary gave at that time. And so Ed Jim Bastiani, the senior military assistant, started keeping a log of the instructions and so forth. But and then there were some, the secretary decided we had evacuated the Pentagon, but we were not going to shut down the Pentagon. We were not going to tolerate this dictation from the enemy. So it's a hazardous site. There's a question about, do we bring people back? And we decided to do it. And then, that night we set up a 24-hour crisis action team and started anticipating next steps. So I've taken too long, but
we're going to come back to you. But I would like to ask Judge Mukasey. I mean, we all know that terrorism did not start on 9/11/2001, and you have had probably more experience dealing with terrorist actions than any other judge in the country. So tell me what you were doing that day, and what do you think? Sort of, when were these seeds planted?
Well, the seeds were actually planted just after World War II in Greeley, Colorado, when an Egyptian educator named Saeed Qutb, who was thrown out of Egypt because he was a he was a disruptive force. He got a traveling fellowship and went to Greeley, Colorado, and was outraged by what he saw, dancing, and he heard the song "Baby, It's Cold Outside," which offended him terribly. He went back to Egypt and started the Muslim Brotherhood. So, if you want us look at what started this, this is one of the few products where if you turn it over, it doesn't say made in China, it says made in the USA. There were acts of violence that were committed in and against the United States before 9/11. To go through a not particularly exhaustive list, there was the murder in 1990 in a ballroom here in Manhattan of an Israeli politician named Meir Kahana, by a man named Syed Nosair. And at the time he was prosecuted as an individual. It was an individual act by an individual defendant, yada, yada, yada. He was disappointed at work and so on and so forth. Fast forward to 1993, the first World Trade Center bombing. Freeing Nosair was one of the objects of that conspiracy. And it turned out when they analyzed the video of the night that Kahana was shot, it turned out that one of the people involved in the 1993 Trade Center bombing was present in the hall that night. The 1994 Bojinka plot to blow up airliners, U.S. airliners, that was actually foiled, although one test run resulted in the death of a passenger because they blew out the side of the airplane. The Khobar Towers, 1996. Killed 19 Marines. The bombings of the simultaneous bombings of our embassies in Kenya and Tanzania in August of 1998, 200 people killed. The USS Cole in 2000 in Aden killed 17 sailors. There was an attempt to bomb another US destroyer, the Sullivans, that failed because they put too much explosives in the raft that they were floating toward it. Obviously 9/11 was not the first time they had accomplished violence against the United States, and certainly not the first time they tried it. I was, at the time, not in the office. I was in a doctor's office. I had scheduled a minor bit of procedure that morning and was coming out of the anesthetic when the head of the security detail that I had a security detail because the 1993 bombing and the an additional plot to blow up landmarks in New York had been the subject of a trial in which the lead defendant was known as the Blind Sheikh, Sheikh Omar Abdul Rahman, who turns out was the spiritual inspiration for the Mujahideen in Afghanistan that opposed the Russians.
How many years had passed since you tried that
case? I tried that case in 1995. I still had a detail in 2001 because he was such a totemic figure. And as I was coming out of it, I asked the head of the detail, is this our guys? And his reaction is, we think so. And you're not going home because we don't know what they're going to do or where they're going to do it. So I did go home to get some clothes and the dog and relocated to another relative's house and started contacting the courthouse just to show you that people, we didn't have a particular plan for anything like this. The courthouse is blocks from where the towers went down, but the air was full of pollutants. As it happened, one quick-thinking member of the maintenance staff fought to close the intake vents on the building and prevented the building from being so polluted that it couldn't be used for weeks, which would have happened had he not done that. Contacted the district executive, made sure the building was closed. Contacted the U.S. attorney, Mary Jo White, who was then in the process of setting up a command center at a pier on the west side so that they could manage any arrests that might occur, because it was clear that the gravity of this or the center of gravity of this prosecution, if it was a prosecution, was going to be in New York. We were still in a prosecution mode at that time.
Well, New York always wants to be the center of every prosecution.
Of course, and but we were in, you know, for everybody else, it was an act of war. For lawyers, it was a case, right? And we mercifully gave that up for a while after 9/11.
Judge, pardon me for interrupting, but I don't know if you know this, but when U.S. forces went into Kandahar, among the things retrieved was a sketch, a detailed sketch of the judiciary square associated with the courthouse that the al-Qaeda had.
Nice to hear about it now. I should mention that it's a good thing we did give up the prosecutive model, at least for a while, because we discovered that in the 1993 trial in front of me with the blind sheikh and his cohorts, the government, as is required to do when it indicts people, it indicts a list of defendants plus others to the grand jury, known and unknown. And so the government is required to serve a list of unindicted co-conspirators. That list of unindicted co-conspirators included a then obscure man named Osama bin Laden. We discovered that 2 weeks after that list of unindicted co-conspirators was served in that case, a copy of that list was in the hands of Osama bin Laden, where he was living in North Africa. And so we put an end to that sort of carnival of discovery when we stopped using the prosecutive model. I was then, as I think I said, I was then chief judge, so I had to. That's, by the way, is an administrative job that's given to people on the basis of seniority. It comes with a grandiose title so that people don't turn it down until they
figure out what it is.
Until they, by then it's too late. I was actually urged to take it by the chief judge of the Second Circuit, Ralph Winter, who said, "Take it; it'll look great in your obit." in any event, I learned that day that the judge who was supposed to be making decisions in emergency cases was living in Battery Park City, which was right near the Trade Center, so he couldn't do it. So I took over that job, and we decided to have arraignments in the court in Westchester County, plus issuing orders to extend deadlines for indicting people who had been arrested but hadn't yet been indicted, for extending deadlines in civil cases and criminal cases and so on. It was a great mercy, I realize in retrospect, that there was all that busy work to do, because I didn't have a chance to wallow in the enormity of it as I did in subsequent days.
Well, terrorism certainly did not end on 9/11, 2001, and we're still fighting it today and probably will be fighting it forever. But there are some things that we have done differently since 9/11. And I'd like to maybe ask both of you maybe what you've seen differently. And I'll again kick off by saying I got back into the country, I think on the 16th, went to the crash site within a few days, saw so many law enforcement, first responders, families, you know, combing the site. They were still collecting evidence at that point. And they showed us some of that evidence, took us into the hangar, seeing the fragments of things that were, collected. And I spent the day following John Ashcroft around, going from point to point to point. It was one of the longest days of my life, really, because it was just the enormity of what was happening that day. And the fact that these people had been there, you know, since the day of the crash, combing those fields, looking for everything that they could find. And I turned to him and I said, "General, what do you want me to do? What should I say?" And I will never forget this. He looked at me and he said, "You tell these people, we are gonna track down each and every one of those terrorists You are going to work with the other 93 United States attorneys who have been appointed, and we are going to hunt them down. We're going to collect every piece of information, and we are going to get them. So it was like, okay. And that's what we did. I mean, all over the country, you know, U.S. attorneys worked with the FBI, with other law enforcement to issue subpoenas, to gather information, try to put all the pieces together. So for me, I would say that what I saw after 9/11 was that law enforcement, federal, state, local, all of the local law enforcement just wanted to come together and do whatever they could. And there was so much of the joint task forces, the ATACs and all the other names for them, just so much cooperation. So for me, that was maybe a silver lining. What did you see maybe with regard to sharing maybe with information sure. and cooperation with other countries?
Well, one of the beauties of our Constitution is that it allows the people through the elected representatives in the Congress, of course, and the President and the Vice President, and then derivatively the judiciary branch to deploy the full force of the country's resources for national defense and justice. They're not alternatives to be chosen at the exclusion of the other. They're parallel authorities. And you know, one of the things that I think in retrospect, the 9/11 Commission decided and collectively we decided was that there may have been a little bit too much rigidity to setting up walls. That, you know, we saw, you know, manifested in things like this fellow Musawi, who had been training to be a pilot, who had no interest in learning how to land. And he and his laptop were, he was arrested and his laptop was collected, but the timing was such that there was not a warrant in time enough to look at his laptop. And there was no sharing between the intelligence agencies who had been tracking people like Musawi and others who ended up on airplanes and law enforcement. So one of the things that the country did collectively together was break down some of those walls and do a whole lot more sharing. I saw it in my job. I mean, as Chief Legal Officer of the Defense Department, I often marveled that there were more lawyers in the Defense Department around the globe than there were in the Justice Department. There were over 10,000 lawyers, depending on how you measure, depending whether people are reserves or guardsmen are activated or not. So we did everything from regulating the wetlands through the Army Corps of Engineers to major corporate combinations with suppliers to fighting wars. But among that was a lot of work with the law enforcement authorities at the federal level, the state level, and even within DOD. So on 9/11, for example, one of the pieces of evidence of the attack on the Pentagon was the video shot that many of you have seen, probably of the plane hitting the building, which was taken by one of the guard towers at the, or guard, not a tower, it's like, you know, big enough for one person at that time, of the plane hitting the building. But one of my lawyers brought that to me for safekeeping in my safe for chain of custody evidence. Unfortunately, we had the sad, spectacle of in the north parking lot. Those of you who've worked at the Pentagon, it's an enormous parking lot around that enormous building where we had evidence collected, and it was a makeshift morgue for weeks at a time for law enforcement purposes while we were at the same time preparing for war. So there was quite a bit of overlap there.
Just to put a little flesh on the bones of the Musawi story, Musawi became an alumnus of one of the many alumni of my courtroom. His laptop, it wasn't a question of timing. The Bureau seized the laptop. And there was a discussion of whether to go get a warrant under the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. And there was fear that because they had been criticized in the past, and because there was great sensitivity about intelligence investigations being used to bring criminal cases, there was to be a wall between intelligence gathering and criminal prosecution. That was the edict that then ruled in the Justice Department. They were scared that they were going to get turned down and rebuked, and they didn't go get a warrant. Another example of how the wall impeded progress. The intelligence unit, the counterintelligence division of the FBI, traced two people coming into the United States in August of 2001 who were suspicious, and they tried to get help from the criminal side of the operation. That wasn't permitted. Those two people wound up at the controls of the plane that hit the Pentagon. That wall, by the way, was resulted from a misinterpretation of the act, and it was later, mercifully one of the casualties of 9/11.
So there were two agencies, really, that no one probably heard of, you know, before 9/11. FinCEN, which existed, but no one heard of it, that grew, obviously, today to be such an important agency with regard to the prevention of money laundering, and the FISA court. So when you became the Attorney General of the United States, both of those, FISA court and, of course, FinCEN and other types of joint collaboration, were really quite developed. What can you tell us maybe that you saw that things were working better by the time you had the reins of the Justice Department?
Well, a large part of my day, virtually every day, was taken up reviewing applications to the FISA court for warrants, usually running 2.5-3 inches thick, and go through them and because they had to be, each one had to be signed by the Attorney General or the deputy. That was a job that I did myself, and always allocated a fair amount of time. It's the process of acculturation, because they don't give you an introduction to what all these applications are about when you arrive. You simply pick it up on the fly.
And they're very thick.
They are very thick.
I review those too for DOD.
And very thorough. But eventually you learn the names of the people, and you learn the recurring situations, and it becomes a little bit easier to review them. But there was a fellow who was actually the brother of somebody who was on television quite a lot, Phil Mudd. His brother would bring the applications to me, and it looked like a mail carrier sack. And I would sit on the desk and I would go through them.
I'm going to ask you each one last question before we turn it over and take. We have time for maybe a few audience questions, but your last thoughts on: Are we safer today than we were on 9/11 20 years ago?
$64,000 question, and what a time to ask that question. I would say with great respect and gratitude for the people who sacrificed for the last 20 years to keep us safe because of the responses after 9/11, no, we're not. From a terrorist standpoint, and I think the reasons for that are, for Afghanistan alone, the sanctuary is back. The terrorists are crowing about a victory against the great Satan. And much more profound, I think, is our credibility is dramatically tarnished in what to do about it. And that spills over beyond the terrorism domain to nation states. So I'm not happy about the current state of affairs.
Judge, you have seen and you've read so much more material than any of us in the public will ever see. What you've seen in those FISA applications, aren't there a lot of things that were being done in the background that have made us at least not attacked on our own soil in the last 20 years?
Absolutely. And those techniques and that bank of information is still there, which is why I take a somewhat different view, but not vehemently, from the view that Jim just expressed. I think we've got a lot more developed in the way of ability to gather information and process it. And obviously, we've got an information bank to build on. That said, there are some aspects of this that are at least as bad as they were on 9/11. The response became a war on terrorism rather than a willingness to look in the face and analyze precisely what the philosophy was that was driving this. Was an ideology. It was not a war on Al-Qaeda. It was not a war on ISIS. It was not a war on the Taliban. This was not a matter of people wearing leather jackets with, you know, the name of a gang on the back, and once you kill all those people, you've won. It was an ideology. And I think this country is fairly uncomfortable with dealing with that, and we haven't dealt with it yet. We're gonna have to deal with it in the future. We've also not dealt with the role of our ally, Pakistan, in supporting the Taliban. You may recall reading that the Taliban used to come out during the fighting season and fight, and then they would go back into their winter quarters. Those winter quarters were in Pakistan. How was it that they kept going back year after year after year? Nobody focused on the fact that they were going back to Pakistan, which, by the way, is a country with nuclear weapons. In addition, of course, we found Osama bin Laden a few blocks from the West Point of Pakistan. So those are things we need to face up to. And I hope it's not a painful road, but it's a road we're going to have to travel.
Well, we have a few minutes to take a few questions from the audience. Mike, don't you have anything you would like to? Well, I call upon Mike because Mike was a former United States attorney also in the Southern District of New York and worked, you know, tirelessly during these years. And so I don't know if you want to ask a question about that, maybe the Patriot Act or whether there's anything there.
Well, Judge McKasey, you know, who I worked with when you were Attorney General, obviously, but I also worked on those early cases, Trade Center 93 and Bojinka 95 in the embassies. It seemed then that pendulum had swung, as you mentioned, very far over to criminal prosecutions. When I came back as U.S. Attorney in 05, it had really swung back the other way out of the courtroom. Where do you see it now? Do you see it as kind of a come back towards the middle, or do you still think there's too much emphasis on criminal prosecution as opposed to intelligence operations or military?
Hard to tell now. I can't let this go without mentioning one forum, which I will admit in the privacy of this room I favored, which is military commissions. The military commission that's prosecuting KSM and the others who were involved in the planning of 9/11, who have admitted many times over, including in private correspondence, that they were responsible for that. The trial hasn't started yet. They're still in preliminary proceedings. Reason for that? I think that the Pentagon, no offense, is a wonderful bureaucracy. And when it's given a job that it really doesn't want, and that is probably inappropriate to it, because, I mean, look, the folks at the Pentagon are trained to kill people and blow stuff up. That's what they're trained to do, and they do it superbly. And to threaten, to pose a real threat to do that. They're not there to run a parallel criminal justice system. And having been given that role and given it under circumstances in which the prosecution itself was distasteful in some ways because some of those people had been interrogated in ways that were icky poo to a large part of the press, they have figured out a way to make sure it doesn't work. When I endorsed that forum, what I had in mind was the kind of criminal the kind of prosecution that resulted was described in a case called Ex Parte Quirin, when a bunch of German saboteurs landed off Long Island, off Florida during World War II. They were apprehended. They were a hapless group in any event, they were captured, tried, their appeals heard, and executed within 3 months. That was kind of the. Now, I will tell you that Justice Scalia has since in a later opinion, once said that that was not exactly the high watermark of due process in the United States. On the other hand, it was a whole lot more efficient than what's going on now.
It was even faster than that. It was before the Supreme Court wrote its opinion.
Yes, they were executed before the Supreme Court wrote its opinion, affirming. The Supreme Court issued an order affirming so that they could be executed, and the opinion came out after they were dead.
Well, if we do not have any other questions, oh. So we'll take these two questions, yours and the gentleman behind you.
Judge Mukasey mentioned that Osama bin Laden knew within 2 weeks that he was an unindicted co-conspirator. Did we ever find out how he got that information so quickly?
Well, that information was provided to the lawyers in that case. You tell me.
Where was the leak? And who leaked it?
I don't want to. I mean, I can't point a finger at any particular lawyer, but it's. The defendants, I believe, got the information as well. And they had their networks, whether it was through the lawyers or through the defendants. The point is that discovery in a criminal case results in the disclosure of information that can fall into the hands of bad guys. And it did.
I think there was a similar incident about the use of cell phones.
Yes, there was testimony about in Judge Duffy's case, I believe, about the use of a cell phone. Apparently information that would be of use to anybody, but when Al-Qaeda learned of that testimony, the United States government had been monitoring a line of communication that was involved in the use of that cell phone. And when the testimony about the cell phone came out Judge Duffy's trial, that line of communication immediately ceased. And so we lost a valuable intelligence source as a result of testimony in a public trial.
One
last question about. I thought I could use my New York City voice, but no. To what extent do you think the Supreme Court's war on terror cases, like Hamdan in particular, muddied the waters or clarified the distinction between trial by military commission as opposed to criminal process, ordinary criminal process in terrorist cases?
I'm at a loss. There's a marvelous bit of dictum that the judge may remember about the Supreme Court. They're not right because they're right. They're right because they're last. The Supreme Court has spoken, and by golly, that's the way our Constitution works, and I support it. I don't have it. On the other hand, I think that there's, and again, I'm out of this game now. I left in 2008. I've been in the private sector for 13 years now, so I'm not following it like I used to follow it. But I think what we have, at least in this context, which is a war against a non-state actor with people who target civilians and don't wear insignia and are not part of an armed force, they're belligerently and obnoxiously outside the realm of the Geneva Conventions. We have a system that is working. It may be very slow, but the commissions that the judge is unhappy with, and I certainly am unhappy with it too. I wrote the first set of rules back in 2001, 2002, which, by the way, were more generous than any previous military commission or international criminal tribunal ever, but incrementally and accretively, more rights have been layered on top. Nevertheless, those people in Guantanamo are still there, except for those that the previous administration let loose to go back to Afghanistan. So notwithstanding that very few of them have been convicted, they are still off the battlefield, not killing Americans, as long as we don't let them go.
So before we close tonight, Jim, you brought some photographs with you. If you just want to take a minute and say what they are in case someone wants to come up and look at them later.
Oh, sure. Yeah, well, there's just one. One of them is of President Bush visiting the Pentagon the day after 9/11. I just thought that might be interesting. And the other is a satellite photograph of the day of the Pentagon the day after 9/11. Just see that. But Judge, you have something much more trenchant to say.
I don't know about that, but I think Handan and cases like that were the result in part, although they should not have been, of what happened at Abu Ghraib and the violence that was committed by undisciplined soldiers, was not authorized, and the Supreme Court decided they didn't want any law-free zone. And so they sprinkled some law, and law being what it is, people take advantage of it, and people have taken advantage of it. It used to be, one of my law clerks gave me an old international law treatise that has a section on unlawful combatants. And the language is that if a combatant doesn't carry his arms openly, follow a recognized chain of command, wear a uniform, and target civilians, that person can be dealt with, as the book says, summarily. Summarily means stand up against this wall, the firing squad will be with you in a moment. That's no longer the rule, we don't do that, I understand that. But that's not necessarily been to our benefit.
Well, thank you both so much for sharing your thoughts on that day.
Thank you.